Radio.
The kingdom of popular soul. Can ethics survive in an age of popular opinion? A presentation by Mr. Scott Stevens at the Christopher Dawson Centre for Cultural Studies 2015 Colloquium.
Look, it really is wonderful being here. I realise it's officially the latest possible talk within the conference. I'm not sure what that means, David. I hope you... I don't know what it means. I'm not going to speculate. But it really is a joy to be here. It's a great privilege to share these thoughts that I have, such as they are, about an issue that I think is particularly important. Can I just also say, lots of people have been congratulating you, David, on the conference. One thing about this conference that really has stood out to me, so many academic conferences these days, you've got your obligatory one or two keynote addresses, and then everyone breaks up into parallel sessions, which means you get world-class speakers addressing crowds of two, three, four people. That's one, I think, travesty. But the other travesty is you don't get the critical mass that happens when everybody's in the same room, everybody's listening to the same papers. You don't get the cross-references. You don't get the kind of gradual consensus that begin to emerge when people are talking together and listening to one another. And to me, that really is one of the great triumphs of this conference. So many things have just resonated and bounced off other things, so much so that I'm just tempted to say that what I've got to present to you today really is little more than an extended footnote to Carl's paper before and Alex's paper just then. So it's a very long extended footnote, but a footnote nonetheless. So thank you, David, for the conference, and thanks for the invitation to be here. Over the last few years, as an active participant in public debate, and as someone who has been, as it were, I mean, it's in my contract, hell, tasked with shaping public opinion. No joke, it's right there, shaping public opinion. I found myself growing progressively less concerned about this or that particular issue, how this or that particular issue is faring in the arena of public debate, and rather more concerned with the condition of the arena of public debate itself. To put it bluntly, the very climate within which public debate is conducted today is such that at best, the conditions invariably favor one side more than the other. Tracy Rowland and I some years ago took part in a public debate with the Intelligence Squared, you know, St. James Ethics Center. And the topic under consideration was the atheists are wrong. We got trounced. Do you really think it's because we mounted the worst argument? I'm participating in another debate in another couple of weeks. The proposition is chastity will save the 21st century. We will get trounced! So either the nature of public debate is such that one side is invariably favored, because the nature of it. I would even say, just incidentally, that the whole debate surrounding legalization of euthanasia, one of the crippling issues is that it's very easy to humanize the case for physician-assisted suicide. It's very difficult to put a human face on the need to preserve what Margaret Somerville calls the moral ecology of human civilization. So the very ability to give suffering a face, I think, skews the debate in one direction, if you understand what I mean. So at best, the conditions are favorable to one side at the expense of the other, or at worst, both sides lose because the angry, agonistic, uncivil nature of the debate debases the issues themselves and destroys any possibilities of persuasion. If you want an example of that, look at federal parliament. The very nature of the debate debases both parties and trivializes the substance of the debate itself. As a result, seems to me that in the current arena of public debate, instead of attempting to persuade, all that both parties can do is to appeal to their own constituents. Accordingly, audiences themselves no longer look to be persuaded, but rather expect their particular point of view to be represented in the public debate in the form of their favorite ideological champion or whatever. In other words, public debate has begun to look a hell of a lot like Q&A. Now, seriously, Q&A is the perfect example, is the perfect illustration of why we have no faith in persuasion. We do not believe that good arguments can persuade people. So instead, all you can have is a panel where you line up your cardboard cutouts of the most representative examples of the most extreme positions on either side of the equation. I could tell you some very concrete stories about attempts to do something other than that that were then overruled because it would have taken a ratings hit. But that's that's another conversation for another day. In other words, we don't want to be persuaded, we don't expect to be persuaded, we just want to see our champion appealing to us. These conditions in which public life is increasingly riven by angry, uncivil rivals with incompatible views about what is good, true, and right are best, it seems to me, described as hyper-pluralistic. It's no longer simply that we have a plurality of competing points of view or moral judgments. This is very much what Alex was saying just a moment ago. It's not just that we have different moral points of view, but we more than that lack a kind of moral vernacular. We lack a shared language through which the arduous process of public deliberation is taken out. In other words, it's the Tower of Babel. Not only can we not agree on the good, the right, and the true, but we no longer have a mediating language by which we might deliberate over competing views of the good, the right, the true. Which itself reflects, it seems to me, the final acceptance of what Rowan Williams calls a world in which there aren't and cannot be real discussion about the goals and destiny of human beings as such. Now, quite apart from my grave concerns about the health of public debate as a whole, I must confess to you all that I have further concerns that the church has either tacitly or all too readily permitted itself to become just another combatant within the arena of public debate, another lobby group, another wielder of potential political influence. It's striking to me that Benedict XVI warned against precisely this in his description of the church's political responsibility in Deus Caritas Est. On the one hand, he reaffirms what the Second Vatican Council called the autonomy of the temporal sphere, the specific responsibility for the just ordering of public life that has been given to the state. Thus, he writes, the church cannot and must not take upon herself the political battle to bring about the most just society as possible. She cannot and must not replace the state. That's what Pope Benedict says. And yet, insists Benedict, she cannot and must not remain on the sidelines in the fight for justice. She has to play her part through, quote, rational argument, and she has to reawaken the spiritual energy without which justice, which always demands sacrifice, cannot prevail and prosper. That's extremely interesting to me. The church cannot be an agent in the just ordering of society, but the church must be an agent in the reawakening of the spiritual energy without which justice, which always demands sacrifice, cannot prevail and prosper. In other words, Pope Benedict is there very specifically trying to trace out the precise role within political public life that the church has, and I would say almost uniquely has. And so he writes, a just society must be the achievement of politics, not the church. Yet the promotion of justice through efforts to bring about openness of mind and will to the demands of the common good is something which concerns the church deeply. So what political role the church does have isn't at the level of politics as such, or of policy, or of prescription. In other words, it's outside of the realm of power and coercion, which are the core business of politics. But rather, it's at the level of the conversion of the imagination itself, the reawakening of openness of mind and will to the demands of the common good. In his justly famous Westminster Hall address during his 2010 apostolic journey to the UK, Benedict explains that the vital contribution of the church is thus to interrogate and inform the ethical foundations of civic discourse. If the moral principles, he says, underpinning the democratic process are themselves determined by nothing more solid than social consensus, then the fragility of the process becomes all too evident. And herein, he says, lies the real challenge for democracy. If civic discourse is based on nothing more solid than social consensus, to paraphrase His Holiness, then society is stuffed. That's the challenge for democracy. Could this mean, here let me get to the nub of the talk, could this mean that the role of the church, and with greatest respect I would also suggest that quite possibly the specific moral responsibility of a public broadcaster as opposed to a for-profit media company or a for-profit newspaper business. Could it be that the role of the church and quite possibly the role of something like the ABC, maybe we're not too far apart after all, that's the private war that some of us are fighting anyway. Could it be that the role of the church is not so much to be one ideological warrior among many, but rather to be the tender and keeper, the shepherd, if you will, of the moral ecology of the public square itself. not one warrior among many, but to set about trying to restore and tend and keep the rules of the debate. Whether or not this suggestion has any merit, it seems to me, depends on what we mean by the word public. We've been talking a lot. Have you been keeping tabs over the last 2 days about how often we use the word public? I mean, if we had more time and if my paper wasn't so long, I'd love to do a bit of a straw poll about what do we actually think the public means. It seems to me the fact that we have not interrogated this concept is one of the great problems that continues to doom and damn so much public debate, but has also severely limited the church's capacity to speak, to act effectively and well. So what might the public be? And with that question, I'm skipping over 4 pages. The public itself, of course, can I say, this is a snippet of 6 hours of public lectures that I delivered for the Australian New Zealand Theological Schools Association conference a few months ago. And it's also part of a larger book that's hopefully to be finished at the end of the year. The title of the book is Breaking News: Can Truth, Goodness, and Beauty Survive in a Media Age? That's the overall kind of idea. Whatever it is the public means, the idea of the public, the emergence of the public, cannot be separated from the emergence of and the activity of the popular press. There are two somewhat related but nonetheless distinct stories that can be told about the relationship between the popular press and the conditions within which the press emerged. The first story is a fairly well-known and fairly heroic story. It's well-known because the media always tells it. It's heroic because the media is the star of the story. And so what would you expect but for a body that is as susceptible to vainglory as anything else and as averse to criticism? Have you noticed that? I'm not going to start. It is... No, I'm not going to start.
Oh, please.
Idols always have glass jaws, do they not? The heroic version of the story goes something like this. It's the story of the throwing off of the old order, of the ancient regime, along with its governing authorities of monarchy and church. It's the story of the revolutionary, quote-unquote, free press as the essential condition of possibility for the revolutionary generation of the late 18th century and early 19th. It's the story of the fledgling America spawning the popular press as a kind of fresh revolutionary medium through which common interests are debated. A sense of national identity was forged, and the very possibility of cooperative action was created. Now, not all of that is false. The press really was a key driver in the age of revolution. Carl was saying this precisely before. The popular press really was a genuinely civic organization within the very young America. Alexis de Tocqueville himself recognized that if there was one body that held together all other civic organizations in the absence of the kind of rediscovery of a new polity, a new sense of national identity, it was the media that allowed, the popular press that allowed people to forge something like a sense of common interest, common good. So much so that in 1803, in his overview of, quote, the revolutions and improvements in science, arts, and literature during the preceding century, Samuel Miller would write that the newspapers, quote, have become the vehicles of discussion in which the principles of government, the interests of nations, the spirit and tendency of public measures, and the public and private characters of individuals are arraigned, tried, and decided. Instead, therefore, of being now as they once were of small moment in society, they have become immense moral and political engines connected closely with the welfare of the state and deeply involving both the state's peace and prosperity. That's Samuel Miller, 1803, talking about the role of newspapers within these new economies, within this new colony. Like I said before, Alexis de Tocqueville saw that the largely party-based newspapers in the U.S., he saw in them a medium of civic association. A newspaper, he wrote, can survive only if it gives publicity to feelings and principles common to a large number of men. A newspaper, therefore, always represents an association whose members are its regular readers. And so this first heroic vision of the narrative enlists the popular press in the service of throwing off the shackles of ignorance and political and religious tyranny, of informing the citizenry and making them participants in the political process, which eventually generates a kind of expectation of political transparency and accountability right up to the emergence, this is the way the story goes, of the full-blown critical culture of the late 1950s and early 1960s, reaching its, you know, peak in Watergate, the great efforts to try to hold power accountable and so forth and so on. So according to this heroic version of the story, which you will have all heard, you know, the press is the great destroyer of monarchs and the overthrow of religion. The press is the driver of revolution and the handmaid of enlightenment. According to this version of the story, the emergence of the popular press coincides with the age of revolution. It's an organ of popular discontent over corrupt establishment or inherited privilege. The relationship between the popular press and political power is thus an antagonistic relationship, so the story goes, and one that persists to this day. It then gets run through the usual figures of Thomas Paine, George Orwell, Ed Morrow, Bob Woodward, Glenn Greenwald, and on it goes. I don't find this narrative particularly satisfying for 4 pages worth of reasons. Just the one that I'll mention already. The narrative begins to fray as soon as you pay any attention to the situation in revolutionary France. For while the French Revolution was accompanied by an explosion of pamphlets and other forms of dissident communication, often promiscuously mixed, we miss this. The new forms of pamphlets and newspapers that emerged in the late 18th century were mixed with lewd satire and outright pornography, as a result of which they all had to be published in the Netherlands and then smuggled into Paris. Political revolution was other kinds of diffidence and other forms of not quite revolution either. It was rank promiscuity as well. As early, however, as 1793, the new regime was already beginning to restrict the latitude and vibrancy of the press. And so at the height of the French Revolution, newspaper circulation reached 300,000 copies per day. But while the growth of the French press was greater and more sudden than in America, this surge was very short-lived indeed, as the French Revolution turned repressive, and many newspapers were suppressed, and journalists themselves lost their lives in staggering numbers. The terror of 1793 and 1794 cost the lives of over 1/6 of the journalists that were active in Paris just 3 years earlier. So this heroic narrative that the press is in the service of revolution doesn't quite hold muster, it seems to me. It also doesn't quite take us where we need to go, because it cannot explain why it was that newspapers suddenly acquired the political significance that they did when they did. After all, the news wasn't invented under the conditions of revolution, either in America or in France, but it somehow acquired a potency under the conditions of revolution that it previously did not have. To put it as simply as I can, revolution enlarged something called the public. And that enlarged public transformed politics. The revolution enlarged the public, and that enlarged public transformed politics. This, I think, points us, or begins to point us at least, in the direction we need to go. True enough, the emergence of the news media as we now know it coincides with a moment of political crisis. This crisis would occasion the fracturing of the hierarchical political order that prevailed until the 17th century, along with the highly differentiated and complementary understandings of society that order implied, what Charles Taylor quite beautifully called hierarchical complementarity. It's not just hierarchy, but each one of those levels, Trinity-like, nurtured and served the others. So it's not just hierarchy and oppression, but it was also life-giving hierarchy. So it's true that the emergence of the news media accompanied the overthrow of that old order, but that was only half of the political crisis. The other half of the crisis was the attempt in this new political order to ground political order and political legitimacy on something as fragile and as unreadable as popular will. When monarchy goes, what's going to replace monarchy? Popular will. A government can only then claim legitimacy when it itself is but the representation of popular will? But by what means do you read popular will? How do you register popular will? How does popular will then impose itself and its own will on the will of the leaders? You can see where we're going here. Now, no one, and I often feel that Jean-Jacques Rousseau gets a bit of bad press, no pun intended. But Rousseau really did try to wrestle with the moral problem of popular will. No one, it seemed to me, wrestled more agonistically, more emotionally than did Rousseau. To be sure, Rousseau placed the newly free individual who had been released from social political institutions, the original individual, the individual who is good and free and autonomous. Yes, Rousseau did seek to put this newly free, self-expressive individual at the center of his political system, and yet for Rousseau, that individual was always tempered by means of, among other things, what he referred to as the social contract. What do we mean, though? What did Rousseau mean by the social contract? What he meant was that individual greed, individual acquisitiveness, individual willing would itself be relinquished to the judgment of what he described as the general will. And the general will, in turn, would give back to the individual the good that he or she is actually seeking. In other words, on his or her own, the individual can't achieve what he or she wants. But by relinquishing, by sacrificing, the general will then gives back what we're after all. Now, it's interesting, for instance, that part and parcel of the social contract is voluntarily entered into mutually agreed coercion in the interests of a good that we can only realize in common. Do you have any interest? Do you have any problem with that? I mean, you're right. That's exactly the idea of marriage. So it's interesting, for instance, that while Rousseau was philosophically liberal, he was actually socially communitarian. The function, just incidentally, of education here for Rousseau is really pretty interesting. Let me just read this one passage, because again, I think Rousseau, I've got no particular truck with Rousseau. I'm not sort of a flag waver or anything, but I just think he was pretty interesting. For instance, Rousseau writes in Emile, good social institutions are those that best know how to denature man, to take his absolute existence from him in order to give him a relative one, in order to transport the I into a common unity, with the result that each individual believes himself no longer one, but part of a whole, and no longer feels except within the whole. That's Hegel, incidentally. I suspect that's also, to some extent, the Apostle Paul. Now, Rousseau, in many respects, is the finest illustration of Charles Taylor's strong contention that modern individualism is not, in its very essence, the solvent of community. Individualism and community need not be antipathetic. Instead, just to the point that modernism is defined by the political problem of the newly free individual, modernity also gives rise to new forms of sociality. Breakdowns occur, as we see in the French Revolution, because people are expelled from old forms through war, revolution, rapid economic change, before they can find their feet in new social structures. What really interests me at this point, however, and this is why I'm bringing up Rousseau, is the role that Rousseau accorded to the press. The idea of l'opinion publique, public opinion, which incidentally for Rousseau doesn't mean what it means for us. For Rousseau, public opinion means something more like shared mores, common civility, what George Orwell described as common decency. So public opinion isn't lots of people believing lots of things, but it's instead, when you strip everything back, just the kind of common decency that's there in naturally good people. For Rousseau, public opinion is the enlightened outcome of common and public reflection on the foundations of civic order. It doesn't even need to be taught. It's just there when you allow decent people to participate freely without government looking over their shoulder in public debate. Now, this is closely related for Rousseau to volonté générale, general will, which is more for Rousseau a consensus of hearts rather than arguments. General will is the natural inclinations that humans have together. This is non-Hobbesian, you'll recognize. For Rousseau, what is at the heart of human beings is the desire to live peaceably. And so general will is what happens when antagonistic structures get out of the way and you allow people simply to come together. And this is articulated for Rousseau through the press. He viewed the press as a non-antagonistic medium, but a way for people to hear one another. Of course! This is realized through the press, but also through salon discussions. And rather than through demagoguery and public persuasion. In fact, Rousseau had no time for what he frequently referred to as silver-tongued orators. The last thing that public debate needs, he said, is silver-tongued orators. You just need to let people be themselves. Now this conveys, doesn't it, the profound fragility in Rousseau's notion of the social contract. Because his great democratic problem was, what happens when votes are no longer unanimous? What happens when people no longer agree? It's interesting, he had no mechanism for the circuit breaker. He had no mechanism for the resolution of public disagreement. And so for him, the ideal model of political or democratic life is the idea of a kind of plebiscite in permanence. This for him was the image of the Greek polis, whereby in the public sphere, public opinion gradually emerges, and that public sphere, incidentally, for Rousseau, increasingly became the press. The press is a kind of plebiscite in permanence, whereby public opinion, common civility, can all be hammered out. This leads to the idea, I think, that still remained quite prominent throughout the 19th century, even just in theory, of the public sphere as that place which enables, or that organ, that function, which, to quote Charles Taylor, enables a society to come to a common mind without the mediation of political power, in the form of a discourse outside of power, which is nevertheless normative to power. So the public sphere is a place where a common mind is reached, which then can exert its will upon the government, but is outside of the reach of political power. Again, however, I'm sure you can see this immediately, this begins raising very, very difficult questions. So, for instance, within the political contract, if representative democracy simply presents itself as the representation, as the embodiment of the will of the people, what happens when the voting booths close, for instance? How does representative democracy continue sounding the will of the people? How does it continue to convince people that it's acting in a way that is legitimate? And this is one of the issues that very quickly presents itself across the 19th century. And let me just quote John Milbank here from his most recent book, Beyond Social Order. He says, "The problem with representative democracy, where political leaders simply present themselves not as leaders as such, but the embodiment of the collective will of the people, the problem is that the will of the represented people become alienated by their representatives who, just to the extent they pose only as the will of the people, but not as leaders, the way that politicians then respond to people, interact with people, is in the form primarily of spin doctors who constantly concoct the spectacle of public opinion and prevailing trends and then hand it back to the people." Let me boil that down into a nutshell. I think this coming week, maybe the week after, on The Minefield, which is the show that Wally Daly and I present on Thursday mornings, we interviewed Robert Wuthnow, who's just done a very, very interesting book called The Invention of American Religion. It's actually on opinion polls. It's on the rise of opinion polls within American public life. It's fascinating stuff. One of the interesting things that you quickly discern about opinion polls is that the rates of audiences taking up opinion polls has, precipitously dropped off the cliff. It's gone from around about 78, 79% of people would respond to opinion polls to now something more like 5 to 6%. At exactly the same time, the reporting of opinion polls, it's ubiquitous. Opinion polls have become the way in which what people really think about a particular issue, what the will of the people really is about a particular issue, becomes captured, reified, separated from the people themselves, placed within the spectacle, the theater of public life, then handed back to the people as if this is what you really think about this or that or the other. One of the points, though, that Robert Wuthnow makes, much like public debate itself, is that the very way in which the opinion polls are conducted, the very questions that opinion polls lend themselves to, skew certain answers. So, for instance, how can you opinion poll religion? Are you religious or not? Do you believe? Opinion polls, by their definition, lend themselves to quite superficial, very easily categorized questions and answers. But when it comes to value, when it comes to a kind of operative metaphysic, when it comes to a way in which one engages and interacts with the world, what poll can register that? So again, opinion polls are becoming increasingly prominent within public life, but at the same time, they become increasingly unrepresentative of people themselves. It's the way in which popular will is captured, is projected, and then is given the role of an agent within the political theater. Does that make sense? I mean, that's a major, major idea, it seems to me, and it's immensely problematic. Essentially, the takeaway from that is do not trust opinion polls. Opinion polls is an attempt to reflect back to people what you really ought to be thinking. Sorry, I've got to keep moving, but can I just also point out? It's opinion polls, then, that also create the spectacle of what it means to be on the right or the wrong side of history. Right? No, I'm not going to go any further than that. Now, there's something interesting happening here, though. Rousseau was aware of this. Alexis de Tocqueville was aware of this. Some of the other great political thinkers and media critics of the late 1800s, early 1900s that I haven't got time to get into now were keenly aware of this. There are two things that are happening by means of the emergence of this thing called the public and the way in which popular will is captured, is represented, and then projected back to people. There are two things that are happening. The first thing that's happening is that the role of popular will as an agent within the political process becomes more prominent than ever. You decide. You vote. Make your voice count. Spectacles like Q&A try to trade in exactly this thing. This is democracy in action. Bullshit. Nonsense. This is not democracy in action because the questions that people submit are oftentimes sent out beforehand by producers. You might want to ask panelists this question. And then they go through, okay, what person do we want then to ask this particular question? And then you want this is why Q&A has become the political equivalent of the Jerry Springer show. You want the most salacious, you want the most antagonistic, you want the person that's going to put the panelist best on the spot. It's confected democracy. And then you've got the steady stream of human waste running along the bottom of the screen. Which, again, is supposed to be your voice. Make your voice heard. And there is someone at a computer selecting which tweets get shown and which we all know this past week, do we not? So I mean, this is interesting to me that one of the... But this is not new. This is the point that I'm trying to make.
It's equivalent to the show trial.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. That's exactly what it is. My point is this is not new. Already in 1893, there were complaints that popular opinion was no longer representative, but the popular opinion was being captured by newspapers in order to increase newspaper circulation, because people did not want to read what the upper class was doing, what this politician was doing, what that politician was doing. The people wanted to be involved, and the press was their organ. And the more people saw themselves reflected in the press, the more they wanted to see themselves reflected in the press, and so the more they bought the paper. This is quite explicit. I mean, this is quite explicit from at least 1893 onwards. You see precisely this critique being made. So on the one hand, people are becoming more prominent as an agent within public life. But now here's the other side of it. That prominence is a mask, is a cover for an overarching political impotence. People appear more prominent, and by appearing more prominent, they're actually lured into a state of ongoing political quiescence. In other words, the popular will appears more, but it matters for less. Citizens go from being citizens to being spectators. I've got pages to demonstrate that to you, so I'm not simply kind of talking out of my, you know, butt. This, it seems to me, is crucial, because what it reflects is that already this idea of a public, which is an all-important modern political concept, is itself something of a phantom. It's something of a spectacle. And again, this is not a new thing. It's remarkable. I would love to be able to introduce this particular person to you even further. It's remarkable, for instance, that the great journalist, media critic, and philosopher Walter Lippmann. You should all read Walter Lippmann, Lippmann. He wrote this quite extraordinary book in 1914 called Drift and Mastery, about the way in which an increased scientific elite being present within the public sphere and public debate could slowly but surely shepherd the role of public opinion away from mystique, away from religious bigotry, away from, you know, sort of superstition and lack of education, and that this increasingly prominent scientific elite could then steer the public more towards enlightened, rational, well-nigh Rawlsian social consensus. 1914. 1922, he wrote an extraordinary book, one of the best books, it seems to me, of public philosophy in the 20th century, called Public Opinion, in which he tried to analyze the epistemology, if you like, of the public, that people are now bombarded with so much information, and all they can do is take that information and put it into pre-existing, what he described as, superstition. Pre-existing worldviews that have no real rational connection, because how do we know how people's view of the world actually gets created? So all they do is they categorize these impressions that they get from media, from politicians, from wherever, and they categorize it and they kind of make these little bespoke Weltanschauung, these little bespoke worldviews that really may or may not have any correspondence whatsoever with reality. Walter Lippmann's endpoint, his solution to all this, is that fundamentally, the public cannot be trusted with democracy. The public cannot be trusted with democracy. And he was one of a number of very prominent public intellectuals that were beginning to look longingly across the Atlantic at other solutions to the problem of democracy, if you can get my drift. Lippmann himself was not a fascist, nor was he a fascist sympathizer. But insofar as fascism arose as a response to the problem of democracy, they were saying that maybe democracy isn't all it's cut out to be. 3 years later, Lippmann then followed up Public Opinion with his masterpiece, which is called The Phantom Public. The Phantom Public. And he says that all these crackpots, all these wackos, are thinking that the problem with public life is that power is still too centralized with the elite, with politicians, whatever, that we need to put more things to plebiscites. The last thing we need in this country is more democracy. That democracy itself, without a virtuous, well-formed, well-informed public, is tyranny. Really, really quite extraordinary stuff. So this idea of the public is already beginning to fray somewhat, because at exactly the point that the public has a renewed faith in itself as a political actor, the public's ability, A, to understand that the world that it's supposed to adjudicate is at an all-time low, but B, that more fundamental social substance that Rousseau was able to presume. That when it came down to it, there was a kind of basic commitment to community. That there was a basic commitment that we are in this together. That certain forms of communality can be discovered through not simply rational debate, but through civic proximity. Those things were all fraying. In other words, the public became this phantom, to use Lippmann's terms. All surface, no depth. Haunting political and public life, but with very, very, very little behind it. I'm skipping over a tremendous amount of stuff here, but I'm hoping you're getting my drift. Now, it should not be surprising. This is a potted history of the rise of the public and the problem of the press. It shouldn't be surprising to you that along this way, those figures that were more critical than anybody else, those public philosophers, public intellectuals who were most alive to the way in which the public itself was a morally corroded idea and the corrosive role that the press was playing in our ability to engage in moral deliberation. Those figures that were most attuned to that were invariably theologians or profoundly theologically influenced persons. Look, one of the reasons that I'm doing this is to try to show that, A, the malaise that we are living in now is not new. In fact, so many of the complaints that we have today, it's like being back in 1917. What we are without today is the acuity, the perceptiveness of the critics that there were at those times. The situation isn't new. The people who are there to tackle it head on are not here. So I want to try to suggest some ways. No, present company included. I want to suggest a number of ways. Because look, the other idea behind this, by the way, is that I think that secularism is maybe an idea that we have not gotten particularly good at engaging with. It's easy to talk about secularism. I'm actually quite interested in the ways in which secularism instantiates itself. And if there is one thing that is the embodiment of secularism, it's the media. The secularism is, or media is, institutionalized secularism. And so I think in many respects, knowing how to engage with this opens up solutions to all sorts of problems and all sorts of other areas of life. Let me present you with three of what I think are the finest critiques of the public and what the media hath wrought. Who said this? Woe, woe to the daily press. If Christ came into the world today, as sure as I live, he would not take aim at the chief priests and so forth, but at journalists. Thus wrote Soren Kierkegaard in 1849. Kierkegaard's account, especially in his journals, of the transformation of Danish society under the conditions of the growing influence of the daily press is both extraordinary and extraordinarily prescient. This transformation, as Kierkegaard insists in his two ages, the Age of Revolution and the Present Age, most fundamentally took the form of what he describes as a monstrous abstraction, the emergence of an all-encompassing something that is in the end nothing, a mirage, namely, the transformation of citizens into, quote, the public. 1846, he's writing this. The public is not a people, not a generation, not one's age, not a congregation, not an association, not some particular person, for these are all what they are by means of being concretions. Rather, he writes, the public is characterized by anonymity, somnolence, passive non-engagement. He tellingly describes the public as perpetually inhabiting a state of indolent laxity. Quote, the public is all, and it is nothing. The most dangerous of all powers and the most meaningless. One may speak to the whole nation in the name of the public, and yet the public is less than ever one so insignificant actual human being. Just lodge that away. I'm going to come back to that. In this state of indolent laxity, Kierkegaard writes, more and more individuals will aspire to be nobodies in order to become the public. That abstract aggregate ridiculously formed by the participants becoming a third party. That sluggish crowd which understands itself and is unwilling to do anything. That gallery public that now seeks to be entertained and indulges in the notion that everything anyone does is done so that it may have something to gossip about. For Kierkegaard, the currency of the public is opinion. What he says, though, now this is very different from opinion in Rousseau's sense. This is our sense of opinion. For Kierkegaard, there was once upon a time no such thing as opinion. The great mass of people, he writes, naturally have no opinion. But here it comes. This deficiency is immediately remedied. I'm imagining Kierkegaard as one of those late night, you know, the people who sort of who try to sell knives and, you know, but here it comes. This deficiency can be remedied by the journalists who make their living by renting out opinions. Don't have an opinion? No problem. We'll give one to you. Just buy this paper. Gradually, more and more people, he writes, are wrenched free from this terrible condition of innocence, in which they were by no means obliged to have an opinion, and are forced into a condition of guilt. You must have an opinion. What can these poor, unfortunate people do? An opinion, Kierkegaard writes, becomes the necessary item for every willful member of this enormous public. And so journalists oblige their assistants by renting out their opinions. Kierkegaard at one point calls journalists whores of opinion. It is interesting, incidentally, there are all sorts of people that I can't mention here. Ilir Belloc would be one great one. Belloc, it seems to me, is actually the greatest early critic of the modern media, especially his New Arrivals. What is it? Survivals and New Arrivals is quite stunning. But I do have to mention Evelyn Waugh. Scoop. Do you remember that one moment? William and Corker arrive at the press bureau. Dr. Benito, the director, was away. His clerk goes to enter William and Corker's names into the ledger, which will give them basically their press pass. Do you remember what happens? They were handed small orange documents, originally printed for the registration of prostitutes. This is what was handed out to journalists. The space for the thumbprint was now filled with a passport photograph, and at the head, the word journalist substituted the otherwise neat Ishmaelite characters. Waugh was wonderful. What Kierkegaard recognized in what he describes as the emergence, the birth, the coming of opinion, is that there's a dual development that's taking place with the emergence of the popular press. And by popular press, I don't mean the salon popular press, you know, the one that the literary elites were reading, the bourgeois were reading, but mass circulation newspapers. Kierkegaard says that there's a kind of dual development that's happening here. On the one hand, the awareness, the knowledge of the public is being massively expanded. They are far more aware of events, far more aware of debates, of controversies, of horrifying accidents, whatever. Their sphere of knowledge has massively expanded. At exactly the same time, the sphere of an individual's moral concern and the ability of an individual morally to respond has massively contracted. We know more, we can do less about it. Now, for Kierkegaard, that had a devastating effect on the moral life because, he said, what it did is it collapsed the distinction between speech and silence. Let me see if I can. This is quite crucial. All of you who know Pope Benedict, the little alarm will be ringing at this point. For Kierkegaard, silence is the realm of interior reflection. Silence is where the hard work of moral deliberation, of soul-searching, of... Remember Benedict's description of conscience, not as doing what one feels is right, but conscience is essentially the process of anamnesis, of remembering what is true, remembering what is the best, remembering what is righteous, remembering what is holy. For Kierkegaard, silence is the domain of deep reflection. I'm confronted by something, and I reflect on what it means and what my obligation to it might be. The emblematic figure of silence, of course, for Kierkegaard is Abraham. Abraham, who was given the command of God and can't tell it to anybody, because by telling it to anybody, he would give himself an alibi and thereby sort of lose himself of his own great moral obligation. So silence is the process of interior moral deliberation. Silence, incidentally, for Kierkegaard, can take place between people. But the whole point is it's not public speech. Speech for Kierkegaard, when I have arrived at this is what this means and this is what I ought to do about it, by then stepping into speech, I am pledging myself, I am contracting myself, I am soldering myself, I am publicly declaring my responsibility. Because I believe this, therefore I must do this. And that becomes a public pledge. In other words, you don't weigh into speech with one's opinion until you are willing to pledge yourself to do something about that. Speech and moral responsibility are inseparable to one another. For Kierkegaard, what chatter, what public opinion is, what opinion is chatter. Morally irresponsible speech. Suddenly, Kierkegaard says that with the popular press, having an opinion became a moral thing to do. Having an opinion became a moral thing to do. And by having an opinion, what was the way in which you let people know you had that opinion? He says, you wear the opinion out like a fashion statement. Hashtags, freaking ribbons on your... go to your Facebook profile. These are all the charities that I support. And then this is the other wonderful thing. This is sometimes called slacktivism. I love this. This is slacktivism. I am so serious about saving the world that I'm going to retweet Greenpeace. I'm so serious about saving the world, I'm going to follow Al Gore. I'm so serious about saving, I'm going to buy a bracelet. I'm going to grow a mustache. I'm going to... So in other words, in a realm where the important thing is having an opinion, but without a moral outlet to do something about that, or without the expectation that your life will change as a result, then all you're left to do is to engage in these cheap acts of moral tokenism, which then become just another form of moral vanity. Welcome to the modern age. But when you do without silence, then the only avenue left, it seems to me, is moral vanity. Because then the moral thing to do is to have an opinion. That then leads to idle chatter, which is just Twitter, which is just most of the op-ed pages that we have today. Idle chatter that means nothing except influencing other people's opinion. Now for Kierkegaard, this is absolutely catastrophic. Because while it expands our knowledge, it decimates, it emasculates our capacity to act morally. That's exhibit number one.
Prescott's revenge,
though, didn't it? It did. Exhibit number two. You really should read Kierkegaard about this, by the way. I mean, the fact that he was on what he was on, the fact that he saw what he saw in 1843, to my mind, is just quite extraordinary. And we're still there today. Another, to my mind, wonderful but rather unlikely response to the problem of the public and the morally corrosive effect of the press on popular life emerged in 1941. Around 1941, 1942, 1943, a number of very prominent theologically influenced intellectuals were beginning to turn their mind from the war effort itself to what sort of society will this war leave? What comes next? In 1941, W.H. Auden remarked in an essay on the task of criticism in mass society that if we care about the right to free criticism, ability to critique what we believe needs to be critiqued, which he describes as one of the most precious privileges in a democratic state, Auden says the first right is to discover how this right is in fact exercised. So we have the right to free speech, to free criticism, but how is that right in fact exercised? Auden writes, it will not take us long to discover that in modern society, whatever its political form, the great majority prefer opinion to knowledge. And the great majority passively allow the former to be imposed upon them by a centralized few. To an extent, Auden recognizes, the influence of a centralized few on the opinion of the many is inevitable. The difficulty presents itself, however, when this influence is either not acknowledged or is itself mistaken for authentic free expression. My opinion is my own. Oh, yeah? Today, Auden writes, a man has only two choices. He can be consciously passive or consciously active. He can accept deliberately or reject deliberately, but he must decide because his position in life is no longer a real necessity. He could be different if he chooses. The necessity that can make him free is no longer his position as such, but the necessity of having to choose it or accept it. To be unconscious is to be neither an individual nor a person, but to be a mathematical integer in something called the public, which itself has no real existence. That's in 1941. In 1942, Auden then wrote a brief article for the Chicago Sun, entitled Poetry in Total War, in which he expressed his concern that, in order to combat the threat of fascism, democracies would themselves have to construct a form of anti-fascist political religion. A religion that would subsume the totality of life, a kind of soft totalitarianism. Later that year, 1942, Auden would begin to give this political religion poetic form as a form of Caesarism in his great Christmas oratio, For the Time Being. It is really interesting, incidentally. I just said a second ago that Auden said, the time has come where all people are forced to a decision. You will be influenced. You either passively accept it or you passively reject it. But just to be unconscious and to thus be influenced is just to drown oneself in the public. And it's interesting that in the words of the prophet Simeon in Auden's oratio, Simeon says, the word could not be made flesh until men had reached a state of absolute contradiction between clarity and despair, in which they would have no choice but either to accept absolutely or reject absolutely. If you haven't read For the Time Being, firstly, shame on you. Secondly, it's the Christmas story set in New York. It's genius. I mean, one of the great works of theological literature. In the fourth part of the poem, the great fugal chorus chants, "Great is Caesar." This is the wise men progressing in front of Caesar. Remember, this form of soft totalitarianism is named as a new kind of Caesarism. The wise men progress in front of Caesar, chanting, "Great is Caesar, for he has conquered the seven kingdoms." These seven kingdoms are the kingdom of abstract idea, a form of epistemological positivism, the kingdom of natural cause, bureaucratic efficient rationalism, the kingdom of infinite number, Fregean mathematics, the kingdom of credit exchange, market economy, the kingdom of inorganic giants, machines, machinery, mass industrialization. The kingdom of organic dwarves, that's the one I love, namely the pharmaceutical industry. And finally, most chillingly, the kingdom of popular soul, namely the achievement of popular consent, but in the form of the release of individual autonomy. The achievement of total popular consent, the emergence of people into a public in the belief that, in so doing, they are simply releasing themselves into their own chosen acquisitive desires. Here's the line from Auden's poem. When he says, this is Caesar, when he says, "You are happy," we laugh. When he says, "You are wretched," we cry. When he says it is true, everyone believes it. When he says it is false, no one believes it. When he says this is true, then this is loved. When he said this is bad, then that is hated. Great is Caesar. God must be with him. Now, Auden's vision, of course, is very familiar to us, for this is the time that we inhabit. By taking part in this all-consuming everything, which is at the same time a great nothing, which by the immersion in this all-consuming something is itself to find oneself in a position of popular consent, this is the very air we breathe. This is liberalism's promised dominion over nature, over human emotion, the form of the pharmaceutical industry. This is its scientific desolation of the sacred with its technological, machinic, and economic suspension of every natural limit. This is the pharmacological triumph over weakness in human and the human body, all in the service of the provision of unhindered individual freedom, a freedom that, when exercised, reveals itself as the very opposite of human individuality and is rather the most terrifying form of all too common banality and conformism. For Auden, this is the service that the press does to Caesarism. The press is the monarch over the kingdom of popular soul. I would love to spend more time on my final example, but let me just point you in the right direction. In exactly the same year that Auden finished For the Time Being, C.S. Lewis delivered his Riddell Memorial Lectures over three evenings at King's College and University of Durham. His chosen topic, of course, was the abolition of man, or reflections on education with special reference to the teaching of English in upper forms of schools. Bestseller, automatically, you can tell. What was so interesting, again, if you've not read The Abolition of Man, shame on you, firstly. I mean, it was C.S. Lewis's masterpiece. But secondly, it was the favorite it was one of Pope Benedict's favorite books, so, you know, there. What is so interesting, and I do wish that I had more time, what is so interesting about the abolition of man is, firstly, it's written in response to a textbook for upper form secondary school English students. This particular textbook, the point of it, very, very similar to the critiques that were beginning to emerge of the popular press in exactly the same period, that the problem with the public is that they're too influenced by advertising, they're too motivated by spin doctors, they give in to emotion way too easily, they lose objectivity. And it was in the late 1920s, early 1930s, that the idea of journalistic objectivity was born. That all you had to do was strip things back to the facts, get rid of religion from the pages of newspapers, no joke. People will see the unadorned truth, will be persuaded by this kind of grim view of reality, and will defer then to a more natural, rational way of life. This textbook, Lewis infamously now calls it The Green Book by Gaius and Titius. It was actually called The Control of Language by Alec King and Martin Kelty. It's a real textbook. I don't know if any of you have read it. It's abysmal. I mean, it's... Because the whole point is, the problem with students is that they're too influenced by emotion. They're too easily persuaded. And so what you have to do is, instead of leaving students in the sway of rhetoric, you need to hand language to students so it's a tool that they can use to manipulate their world. It's a very grim view of reality. Lewis used this opportunity as his way of making final accounts, if you like, with what was called the new look, what he liked to call the new look. It's kind of Oxford realism. It's basically Dawkins. One of the very interesting things to me, and I'll just do this very, very briefly. One of the points that Lewis makes, which I think is indispensable for our time, is the idea is that the nature of human progress is that we are slowly but surely stepping out from under tyranny, manipulation, and control. And by having language, emotion, placed back in our grasp, placed back in our control, we will become progressively and ever more free. For Lewis, the reality of the human situation is precisely the inverse of that. He writes, the dominant idea of progress, that a progressive emancipation from tradition and a progressive control of natural processes will result in the continual increase of human power, Lewis says that nothing could be further from the truth. Instead, he writes, in order to understand fully what man's power over nature is, and therefore man's power over other men, really means, we must picture a race extended in time from the date of its emergence to the date of its extinction. Each generation exercises progressive control over its successors, and each, insofar as it modifies the spiritual and natural environment around it and rebels against tradition, resists and limits the power of its predecessors. There is therefore no question of a power vested in the race as a whole, steadily growing as the race survives. Instead, it is a constriction. The last men, he writes, far from being the heirs of power, will be of all men most subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners, and will themselves exercise the least power. Each generation passes on its weaknesses and limitations to the next, so the last men will be of all the most pitiable. Interestingly enough, I wish I had time, Lewis wrote a novel at precisely the same time that he was writing Abolition of Man. It's the final volume in the Ransom trilogy called That Hideous Strength. It's a kind of perversion of Pilgrim's Progress. The central character, Mark Studdock, is the last man. At one point, Lewis describes him as having an education that was neither scientific nor particularly philosophical, just modern. As a result, he says, any moment of decency left passed him without notice. Any moment where moral courage was required sent him sprawling. He's a man particularly, uniquely, without either courage or conviction. There are two things that he wants in life. Well, actually, one thing, which he manifests itself in two. He just wants to be on the inner circle of something. He is this runty, pathetic, worm of a man who will do anything, who will say anything in order to be in the inner circle. And Lewis says, it was this unique set of characteristics that equipped Mark Studdock to one profession and one profession only. He was a journalist. Now, why am I saying all this? Well, for Lewis, in this period in the mid-40s to the late-40s, it seemed as though the way in which humanity can pass through this period of darkness and mystique and violence is to regain clear-sightedness, to adopt a form of enlightened cynicism as a way of looking both at the past. Lewis famously called that chronological snobbery. Just by virtue of being past, it's worse. So cynicism becomes a way of looking at the past, but also of seeing clearly through the designs of the moment. In other words, cynicism becomes a virtue. Cynicism becomes a way of seeing clearly through things, of not being unduly persuaded by things. Lewis, of course, was quite critical of this. He says, you really think that the way to combat false emotions is with no emotions? The only way of combating false emotions is with true emotions. He has this wonderful phrase where he says that the proper task of educators isn't to mow down a forest, but to irrigate a desert. You're not trying to rid people of false emotions. You're trying to give what he once describes as trousered apes and urban blockheads. You're trying to fill them with longings for what is best, rather than just kind of pathetic pantings for what presents itself. But Lewis also says that the thing that gets lost in the middle of all of this, in the midst of this cynicism, is the capability to recognize what is worthy of merit, to long for what is truly good, to be persuaded by what is self-evidently true. In other words, to believe that those things that are out there that are beautiful really are out there and really are beautiful. This is a great Augustinian, a great Aristotelian notion of education. The role of education is to train the emotions properly so they long after the good, so they pursue the beautiful, so they respond to the true. Let me leave you with three recommendations. Very brief, it's one line each. If we take these criticisms seriously, if we regard the public as something that I would suggest to you is not really worthy of quite as much church concern as it currently gets. Do you really think we win public debates? I don't. If you accept, as I do, that the public doesn't exist, but the public is largely a spectacle created by the media in order to attract people to websites, then I think the idea of public debate becomes immediately problematic. Let me give three very, very simple recommendations. Firstly, as Christians, for the sake of our own soul and for the sake of the task of the church, we need to recover silence. What does that mean? You don't have to have opinions about everything. You don't have to have opinions about everything. I would suggest read less news. Pay for what you do read. That's the way of investing a degree of value and making sure that these things continue to exist. Read less news. Pay for what you do read. Read more novels. Read more of Benedict XVI, read more Augustine. But realize you don't, as much as the media demands it of you, you don't have to have opinions about everything. But when you do have opinions about something, let that emerge from the fullness of that reflection, being informed both by what might be transpiring in the news and also from what you read in Les Murray, or what you read in T.S. Eliot, or what you read in Jane Austen, or what you read in Marilynne Robinson, or what you read in Flannery O'Connor, or Walker Percy. In other words, let silence become the place where you decide, where you reflect upon those things that truly must be distinguished from the simply insignificant or the simply secondary. As Pope Benedict said, silence gives rise to even more active communication, requiring sensitivity and capacity to listen, that often makes manifest the true measure and nature of what is best and what is most urgent. When information and messages are plentiful, silence becomes essential if we are to distinguish what is important from what is trivial and what is manufactured. Recover silence. Read less news. Don't be part of the public. Secondly, we need to renounce cynicism. One of the lines of C.S. Lewis that Pope Benedict was very fond of mentioning, to see through all things is the same thing as not to see at all. To see through all things is the same thing as not to see at all. To think that you can just spot hypocrisy at a glance. To think that all politicians are basically bastards. To think that this person has ulterior motives about this, or this person is seriously conspiring that. Cynicism, this all-pervasive cynicism, has degraded our entire public conversation because we simply will not trust one another. And the more that Christians engage in the same game, the more we are deepening the blackness of the present moment. The time has to come to engage in, even if it's a willful suspension of doubt, to step into a place where we begin to believe the best, to trust the best, to hope the best, in the hopes that by believing the best, by trusting the best, that might elicit genuine virtue, genuine trustworthiness in response. Cynicism is killing us. Forget doubt. Cynicism is killing us. Finally, screw the public. Forget public debate. There is no public to be persuaded. As with all things, arguments are won not so much by the quality of the argument, but by the life, the example of the person, and by the imaginative possibility in the person receiving the argument. I mean, Wittgenstein very, very famously said, most arguments are won by this person encountering this person at this time. I would suggest to you that in just the same way as Kierkegaard said that one ever so insignificant person is worth more than the entire public, being able to powerfully, profoundly persuade by means of life example, by means of long-term dialogue and debate, not some sort of quick exchange. When minds are changed in those contexts, that is worth 1,000 public debates, it seems to me. A simple, gradual accumulation of hearts and minds that are convinced by truth, goodness, and beauty. That's the way to begin winning public debates, not by sending these messages out into the ether. I'm not saying to absent ourselves from public debate, but I do think we need to recognize what it is we're doing. I suspect that we're less and less trying to win this particular point, and I suspect that our task really should be more and more to try to convert the imagination, to try to alert certain people that there are certain things that can be seen only when one is willing to immerse oneself in the drama of one's own salvation. Thanks very much.
That was Mr. Scott Stevens with The Kingdom of Popular Soul. Can ethics survive in an age of popular opinion? This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 colloquium on the theme Ideas Dangerous to Atheism. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.